Would you like to reserve a portion of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
All right. You have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, I'm Chair Ashby, I'm here to represent the issues broadly. The issue essentially is that the trial court errors that Florida Statute 817.52 is substantially similar to the corresponding Virginia Statute 18.217. Because it is not substantially similar, it doesn't count as a...
Can I ask you to speak up just a little bit more? I can hear you, but... It just for a recording of it, sometimes if you speak not loud enough, it won't record well.
Plus, he knows I'm old and hard of hearing.
Okay. Have you heard everything so far?
Yes.
Essentially, it shouldn't be considered as a predicate conviction for purposes of enhancing it to a third subsequent a felony larceny in this case. Basically, the argument that I have was probably inadvertently provided to me by the Attorney General's brief. I'm taking this from Chenault, I'm not sure if I'm butchering the name of that case. It is Virginia.
Virginia 269.
Essentially, what I've taken from that particular case and the cases that have, interpreted it thereafter, is that because there was a conclusive presumption in the North Carolina DUI laws that 0.10 or more blood alcohol content were under the influence, and that Virginia's DUI laws had just a rebuttal presumption, that in and of itself was enough for the Supreme Court to find that they were not substantially similar.
Can I ask you about that then? Because I think I see where you're going here. And so if the North Carolina statute, because it was a conclusive presumption, it was easier to get a conviction than in North Carolina than it was in Virginia. So it's broader. And that's a major concern if we're saying it's a substantially similar crime or conviction under a substantially similar statute. Here in Virginia, you have a prima facie aspect to this, which the Florida statute did not have. So wouldn't it be harder, therefore, to get a conviction in Florida than in Virginia? So if anything, the Virginia statute's broader than the Florida one, which would mean there's no problem. Can you help me on that?
Essentially, what it boils down to is that in Florida, for their particular bill to return rental property agreement, the prosecutor or state's attorney or what have you has to show, I'm guessing, some affirmative action or some affirmative showing of an intent to defraud. Whereas when you have Virginia cases, if the requisite is met, the 5 days past the expiration of the lease, if that is met in and of itself, that means that the court can infer it is a larceny, which case law has very clearly stated that means intent to defraud. So essentially, it's essentially you have some affirmative showing of proof of intent to defraud in Florida, whereas in Virginia, you don't necessarily have to have that as long as you meet that one little requisite. So the elements there are not actually the same. That's what I'm saying.
Does it have to be actually the same? Or you have the same crime, essentially, but the Virginia statute, the statute from outside Virginia can't be broader than the Virginia statute.
I understand that is the current, presence of the case law, but what we contend is that the proposition in the opposite would also, I'm not very articulate about this.
That the inverse would also be a problem?
Yes, that the inverse would also apply, because either way, they're not substantially similar. It doesn't particularly matter if Virginia's is broader or Florida's is broader. If they're not substantially similar, they're not substantially similar, and you can't really do anything about that. And essentially, we're saying that because of that substantial difference, that the conviction for Florida should not have been taken as a prerequisite for 18.214. Does the court have any other questions for me about that?
I think you can proceed on with your argument then.
I guess just to address the Attorney General's argument that it was barred by 5A18, our argument is that it was not barred. It was incredibly, indelibly clear to the trial court that I was objecting to the use of the convictions for Florida as prerequisites for 18.2104. I mean, the very, very clear, the motion in limine said it's because they're not substantially similar. The guilty plea questionnaire form itself, if you can actually decipher my chicken scratch, says the substantially similar issue. That is encompassed within what I'm arguing today. I preserved that record as best as I could, and I really don't understand how it could have been not preserved. I believe it was very clear, the judge was very clear too, on the record, that I was preserving the argument, the ruling that he had made in the motion, or motion in limine. So at that point, I would just say that I did preserve the argument, and I'll...
You made the argument, if see if I understand what you're saying. You're saying you made the argument that the statutes were not substantially similar.
Yes.
You didn't specifically make an argument that the difference was the rebuttable presumption of the 5 days, or the prima facie evidence of the 5 days. Is that right?
That would be accurate. But essentially, I think that the crux of 5A18 is that the court understands what your objection is at the time. And my objection was very clear. I was very clear when I was asking the court to do at that time. I was asking the court to find the statutes not substantially similar and hold that the Florida conviction in question could not be used as a predicate against. Does the court have any other questions for me? Okay, so I'll just reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. You have the remainder time for your rebuttal. Ms. Kiernan?
Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Kiernan, and I represent the Commonwealth in this appeal. The two statutes at issue before the court today are substantially similar. They have the same elements. Both statutes criminalize the failure to return leased property in contravention of a bailment agreement, and both statutes require that action be done with the intent to defraud.
May I ask you at the outset, Ms. Kiernan, which we're being asked to determine that Florida statute section 817.52 is substantially similar in this matter. And perhaps it's my own failure, but for the life of me, I cannot find that statute in the record of this case. Where in the record is the statute we're being asked to determine is substantially similar?
I think in the transcript, Your Honor, it appeared that the prosecutor passed those statutes up to the trial court.
But if that happened and it's not a part of the record, is that not a problem for us? Because it does not appear that they were ever asked to be introduced. It does not appear that the trial court ever entered it into the record, nor did either the prosecutor or the judge read the statute in its entirety, unless you can just point me to something that I'm missing.
Off the top of my head, Your Honor, I can't point you to that place in the record. I'd be happy to submit something further if the court would like that. However, two responses. First, if there's any deficiency in the record, that at this point in the proceeding, marshals against the defense. The defense has an obligation to bring forward the court the appropriate record and to provide with the court.
How does it marshal against the defense, though, when it's the Commonwealth's burden to show substantial similarity and we're tasked with then reviewing that statute?
Yes, Your Honor. However, on appeal, the defendant has the burden to show that the trial court erred in that respect. And I think as we're here in this posture, it's no longer the Commonwealth's burden in the first instance there. However, we're talking about the codified code section. Trial court can certainly take judicial notice of the laws of this Commonwealth. I would say that they can take notice of the laws of other commonwealths. Also,
but doesn't the trial judge have to do that? Doesn't the trial judge have to be asked and affirmatively do that?
Yes, Your Honor. Where the court makes its ruling, actually, I believe it's quoting from the code section, which I think would imply that the court had read it. I'm looking at page 190 of the record, where the court says the, 18, failure, let's down, line 22, when we're specifically talking about 817.52 sub 3. And then he continues, and then in the detailed discussion that follows, the court quotes, I don't have this flagged and I apologize. Would the court permit me to grab my brief?
Certainly, absolutely. Are you looking at page 190 of the appendix?
I was initially because that is where I have the flag here. However, I'm looking for the court's ruling because there is a back and forth between defense counsel and the court, wherein the court quotes the language from the Florida Code.
Quotes it at the bottom of 190 and 191. Is that what you're talking about? From the floor, 817.52 subpart 3. Is that what you're talking about? Lines 25 through lines 3 on the next page.
There is a place, Your Honor, I think, where it's even more detailed than that.
Okay.
Don't feel bad. We come up with these things all the time.
Right. Take your time.
Yes, of course, I just wasn't reading closely. Yes, Your Honor put his finger on the site I was looking for. It is at the bottom of page 190. The court quotes 817.52.3.
Is that the entirety of the code section?
No, Your Honor, it's not. However, the court is only required to find the specific subsection under which the defendant was convicted in this case substantially similar. This court's holdings in Cox, as well as subsequent holdings in Dean and Dilsworth, both refer to the specific subsection under which the defendant was convicted. And in this case, if you look, the record starts at 208.
Is that the entirety of the subsection? And if so, how are we to know that?
Because, Your Honor, I think that trial courts are presumed to know and follow the law, and the judge here is quoting from a particular subsection of this law. It's been brought to his attention.
But I guess that's my point, is quoting from the law as opposed to quoting the law. And how are we to know if the statute is not in record, whether or not he's quoting all or a portion of the selected statute or subsection?
Because, Your Honor, this court reviews this issue de novo on appeal, and when we're comparing code sections in the abstract, I think this court necessarily has to look at those two code sections, whether or not they are in the record. I think it's clear the trial judge had that in front of him.
So we're to go behind the record and do our own research on this?
I would disagree, Your Honor, that it was going behind the record when the trial court so clearly had the code sections in front of him, in particular the specific subsection under which the defendant was convicted. As opposing counsel has mentioned, there was a motion in limine filed in this matter. It was briefed by both parties. The trial judge went painstakingly through the Florida code. He pointed out, for example, that retail theft and grand theft auto were charged under Florida's general fraud statute and not under Florida's bailment statute.
And you may not know this off the top of your head, but does the Commonwealth's response to the motion in limine have contained the relevant code sections in it?
I don't know if
that's okay.
But it would be our position that these were certainly fairly in front of the court.
But I guess I'm just trying to reconcile that with the notion that there can be many opportunities for a piece of evidence to be fairly in front of the trial court, but unless he marks it as admitted into evidence, it can't make any difference to us. Just because he was staring at it, and it's clear from the transcript that he's staring at it, unless he marks it as evidence, we can't consider it.
Your Honor, the Florida statute isn't evidence in this case in the way that a certificate of analysis or DNA.
And I know I wasn't comparing specifically apples to apples on that.
But in that way, when the parties appear before the circuit court and they advise the court of this court's law, they ask the court to rule that Jones versus Commonwealth, there's a strong connection between drugs and guns. The party doesn't have to then proffer that case law for the court to then look at in order for it to be properly before the record on appeal.
Whose burden was it to make the record clear so that a reviewing court could potentially have that code section or the subsection of that code section explicitly in front of it if it's to seek review on substantial similarity?
Your Honor, I would maintain that it's the defense's burden. Their motion and their argument.
At the trial court level?
Yes, their argument. No, I apologize. At the trial court level, initially, the Commonwealth bears the burden to show substantial similarity, and then if the defendant shows evidence of dissimilarity, you can come back and that kind of thing. However, on appeal, if the basis of the defendant's argument is that the trial court erred by not finding these code sections substantially similar, and this court feels it needs that information to make that determination, it's the basis of the defendant's objection. At that point, I would say the burden was on them to make sure it was fairly before the court. However, I don't think the legal authority has to be contained in the record for the parties to be arguing it on appeal. Did you save me?
It looks like we might have Commonwealth's Exhibit, Florida statute, but keep on going.
And I think that there were two Florida statutes that were a part of the record, but not the one that the trial court found.
Not the one that the trial court found.
Substantially similar.
Mm-hmm. They're in the appendix.
And I waited to ask the next question just because I thought Judge Decker might have found what I've been unable to find. And just to follow up on your, still think it's the defense's responsibility at the stage of appeal, but I'm just trying to figure out what kind of burden it places upon the defense to then produce something on appeal that's not a part of the record at the trial court level. How are they to do that?
Your Honor, I think that because we're talking about a code section, a legal authority that exists independently of anything else here, there is no burden on anyone to put that black letter law in the record for the court to consider. Didn't argue that she had defaulted the issue on that basis either.
I guess here's the problem. We understand what, matter of law, we can look at all that. I guess what Judge Attlee is struggling with is that we can presume that the trial court knows the law and has something that he or she is looking at in front of them, but if we're being asked to make a determination of substantial similarity, certainly if we were doing independent de novo, we can look. The question becomes, how much do we have to take into account any of the findings of the trial court that don't relate to strictly legal matters? In other words, if we're reviewing a statute, particularly a Virginia statute, we just pull up the statute and it's a matter of law, is the same true when we're looking at an issue of substantial similarity of an out-of-state statute? Because most of the time, it's either put in the record or the judge reads it into the record or somebody reads something into the record.
To that point, Your Honor, I think it was read into the record in this case, although I'm not sure I'm grasping.
Your position might very well be that the relevant parts of the statute are read into the record.
Mm-hmm. I think that they are. Again, I
and your opposing counsel is going to be ready to come up and answer us.
No, they're not. I think speaking of this court's standard of review, we have there are two types of issues here, right? First, whether the statutes are, and this is the way that this came about. I think is particularly significant in this context because we had a motion in limine. We're talking about whether these convictions would be admissible for the Commonwealth to later prove. Substantial similarity at trial. So the trial judge's ruling here is that these are admissible because they are substantially similar. And the issue for the court on appeal now is, was that substantial similarity analysis flawed? And you know, what, how does that impact the admissibility of these convictions? So to the extent that the court is doing a de novo analysis, we're comparing the elements of those two things to find out whether the trial court erred in a matter of law, which would then make the admission of these documents into evidence of an abuse of discretion. So I think that in this, don't have a lot of factual considerations in play here when we're comparing the black letter law of the statutes as this court has done most recently with Mason and Dean in Dilsworth before that.
Is it your argument that it doesn't, we ought to be able to take judicial notice of it ourselves because it's just the black letter law of Florida, just like there's black letter law in Virginia? And if so, how do we know, although perhaps research today would allow you to very quickly to determine whether it was a law in place at that time, that no wording of the Florida statute had changed in the meantime, what we would pull up than what was here when he was convicted?
I think my position, Your Honor, is it's the same as case law. The parties were to cite case law to the circuit court, the parties were to cite case law to this court. You don't have to take judicial notice of, you know, if I were to say this is a Maryland case and this is persuasive authority, it's not you know, binding on this court or whatnot. You don't have to then take judicial notice of what the highest court in Maryland found. It is the law, and it's available to this court to use and adopt if the court finds persuasive, and to distinguish if the court finds that the Virginia law on issue is controlling. And we don't have to take judicial notice of it, per se. I feel like there are probably appropriate words to describe the distinction. I don't have them. I apologize. But I think it just is the law, and this court certainly, in considering, you know, other code sections. Was the law at that time. And I think... Dean or Dilsworth both deal with, you know, I think they're robbery convictions out of Maryland, and they talk about how the common law of robbery has developed and going back and looking at what it was like at the time that he was convicted. And again, and we're analyzing here the law. We're not analyzing their conduct at the time. The court's been very clear that what we're not doing is looking through to the conduct of the defendant. We're looking to see whether, you know, under the laws at that time, he was convicted of in Florida would have given rise to a conviction here in Virginia. And that's certainly the case in this instance. And as the court pointed out, you know, even if, and I disagree that the ease of conviction is the appropriate standard here, but even if that was the case, the Florida statute, it would be more difficult in Florida to gain this conviction because the Virginia prosecutor doesn't have the benefit, or the Florida prosecutor, rather, doesn't have the benefit of the permissible inference that we have in this case. So we certainly, may I conclude, Your Honor, sure. My time has expired. The purpose of the General Assembly in enacting these substantially similar provisions is to limit the type of cases that can be allowed as aggravating factors. And in light of the two code sections in this case, it's certainly not the case that a defendant's conviction from out of state was broader than what the General Assembly would have considered for an aggravating offense in 2004. And if the court would like more information on the judicial notice or how it is that code sections from other states come before the court, I'm happy to submit supplemental briefing.
If I could just ask one more question.
Certainly.
Sure.
So I just want to clarify, your position on the Florida statute is substantially similar is a question of law that we review de novo,
yes,
and we look to the law.
Correct. Okay. Thank you. Anyone else?
Your question. Thank
Sorry.
You. Ms. Ashby, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, judges. And actually, I was in this case, my over analysis and over research has actually come to my defense. I have a case from the Supreme Court of Virginia, Ruffey versus Commonwealth. It's 221 Virginia 836.
I'm sorry, say that name again.
Ruffey, Ruffey.
Is that in your brief? Did you cite that
it
in your
not,
brief?
It is not, but it was one of the cases I found while researching for the argument here today.
Okay, can you make sure opposing counsel gets a copy of that? Because you're not really supposed to argue outside your brief, but we've gone all over the place, so why don't you?
What was the site on that again, please?
It's 221 Virginia 836.
As Judge Decker said, if you would forward that to opposing counsel and maybe just copy the court on that as well, that'd be great. Thank you.
essentially this was another, it was a case that was slightly before the Chenault case. It has to do with the North Carolina statute, again, the one regarding the rebuttal versus irrebuttal, rebuttal versus conclusive presumptions. In this particular case, it seemed that, there was no evidence offered below concerning the provisions of North Carolina's laws on the subject of the similarity, basically, of the laws to the drunk driving statutes. In this, it says that, obviously, certainly at the trial court level, the Commonwealth attorney is the one who bears the burden to prove that there's substantial similarity. But apparently, at least according to this argument, it is still upon the court there found that it was still upon the Commonwealth to prove this substantial similarity for pretty obvious reasons, because obviously the defense doesn't have an obligation to put on any particular evidence in regards. It is up to the Commonwealth to prove all of the elements, and in this case, one of the elements would be, is it substantially similar? That burden is on the Commonwealth to do that. The court in this case stated that because the record of the proceeding below does not show the provisions of the statute, one must resort to speculation concerning those provisions and must engage in conjecture to conclude they are substantially similar to Virginia's drunk driving laws. And essentially they found that because there was nothing in the record, the court there had no ability to find if it was substantially similar, and they found that they could not do that and reverse the conviction, essentially. And I would still maintain my argument that I made before, that even if Virginia's statute is broader than Florida's statute, the fact that they are substantially similar, it still holds. Substantially similar is substantially similar. If it's not, it's just not. I don't believe it has anything to do with which state statute is broader, which is narrower. It has to do with, is it substantially similar? In this case, it is not substantially similar. I'd ask the court to find that, and I'd ask the court to remand this to the circuit court for resentencing on misdemeanor larceny. Any questions?
Any further questions for Ms. Ashby?
No.
Judge Atlee? Okay. When I mentioned if you could submit that case to opposing counsel, I probably should also say that then if you want to respond, having read it and reviewed it to the court, you certainly may do so, and of course, copy opposing counsel.
Sure.
And yeah, the sooner, I think, Judge Decker made a good suggestion, because we don't want this, you know, we want to move along in deciding your case. So if you could submit the case and copy the court so that within, a week, and then you take another week to submit your response, then that way we won't have allowed too much time. It shouldn't be too hard for either of you, I wouldn't think, to do that. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. We will greet counsel, and then this court will be in recess until 9:00 tomorrow morning.